Welcome, everybody, to Workplace Strategies. I have three very special guests today. Joanne Mosier, Senior Consultant with Stuart Cooper & Coon. Bill Temple, Senior Consultant with Stuart Cooper & Coon. And Valerie El-Jamil, also a Senior Consultant with Stuart Cooper & Coon. And today's topic is value proposition. What is it? It means a lot of different things to a lot of people. So I thought we would have a discussion with some of the most professional coaches in the United States about what this is and why it is so important to securing better positions, better money, better value perception by the company. Let's start. Bill, would you mind sharing what you think value proposition is?
Thank you, Fred. To me, value proposition is a way of communicating in a very summary way the essence of what a person can be and be in terms of what he or she can do for someone else. One of the things that I try to remind people is that unfortunately you're not worth a plug nickel to anybody unless you can indicate that you can increase their value in some way greater than the cost of hiring you. And as a result of that, it starts from the very moment that a person introduces him or herself to an organization. And so the value proposition to me is simply a brief statement that says, I'm already in your space. Let's have a conversation about what we can do together. And that could take a number of different forms, but it really is about, I'm here because what I have is what you need, not, you know, a 20-minute dissertation on all the things that a person might be or have done in the past. And most of which nobody cares about it. We talk too much because we think more is somehow better.
Valerie, I'm sorry. We're going to have to start. Valerie, we're going to have to start over because the pause button wasn't released. We are now recording. So, Valerie, let me start over.
And I got all that out without coughing.
I know. Go ahead and cough because we're not. I'll tell Sam will hear all this. So, okay. Sam, here we go. Silence. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Valerie El-Jamil, what do you think value proposition is, and why is it important to a job seeker to establish that in the mind of the hiring authority?
Well, recognizing that the term value proposition is used in many different ways, the essential message that we want our clients to be delivering is, if you hire me, I can deliver results that impact the top and bottom line or both. I can create harmony, collaboration, and a better culture in your company. So the idea here is that it's an integrated branding statement that you can use across various different uses in order to convey a consistent message that quickly reflects what makes you valuable to a potential employer, and thereby articulating the types of results that an employer can expect if they were to hire you.
Joanne Mosier, what are your thoughts on value proposition and how a client can secure better income or better position by having a better value proposition? What does better mean?
Okay, thanks, Fred. Face it, when we are in career search, we are a product, and we need to be able to sell our product to a potential employer, and then they need to fully buy in and believe that we bring something that another candidate does not. So very similar to when we buy a car. We have to believe in our heart that that car is going to get better gas mileage or give us some better features that the other cars that we've looked at don't. And then, in fact, we may be willing to pay more to get those features if we can see enough of the value. So career seekers are no different. Now, that might seem a little clinical, a little mercenary, but we need to sell our value, and I consider the value propositions are the way to do that. You need to have short, impactful statements. They need to be tailored for each use to sell you to potential employers without them being just a recitation of keywords and phrases. They need to have verbiage. They need to perk up the ears or catch the eye, I would say, of the potential employer. A bit of dynamic, bit of success, something to reach out and grab somebody. So it's much like when you get a fish, when you're going fishing and you get a fish on the line. You can't give the fish all the bait at one time. You need to reel an employer in slowly, offering those tidbits. And these value propositions are exactly that. They become part of your resume. used in your cover letters and noted in your conversations with potential employers, but at all times they need to answer, what am I saying that's going to have this employer buying me as a product?
Thank you, Joanne. Valerie El-Jamil, can you talk a little about defining achievements and the quantifiable inclusion within those?
Well, one of the major points of that I'd like to bring forth on that is that so many times people focus too much in their quote-unquote achievements on their actions rather than on the value that you deliver to a potential employer or that you have delivered to a past employer, rather. So that if you start your achievements by fashioning them with the value you have delivered so that you capture the attention of that potential employer with, oh, wow, they've done that for another company. Heck, I can get those same results. Then follow it with a little bit of an action-type verb of how you did it. And the way that I have my clients structure them is, I delivered this by doing this, so that what you've done for an employer in the past is in the past tense, but it captures the attention because there's a number there, a quantifiable, a way that the company has been improved. And then the secondary part of the statement, by doing, the ing verb, by creating, by developing, that active verb makes it applicable to this new potential employer's situation. So that what a achievement essentially does is I can add value by doing something, by taking some action, by delivering, by developing, by creating, whatever that ing verb is that you choose. And that gives that sense of life to your resume as well as to how you speak about yourself in an interview. If you use past tense verbs all the time, what ends up happening is you sound dead, done, and over with. But if you use these active verbs, you're alive, and it captures attention and draws your interviewer or the people that you're speaking with, draws them into the conversation.
Thank you, Valerie. I know that we have all heard over the years that we have a elevator speech, a one-minute commercial, a value proposition statement, an achievement statement. What are the differences? How should they be used? Let's start with you, Joanne Mosier.
Well, I actually have a tendency to think of the one-minute commercial, the elevator speech, the tell me about yourself as sort of all one and the same. And I think of those as separate from value propositions in that I think when you lead off, when somebody begins the interview with, so tell me about yourself, I want to give them certain things and get it out in a minute, minute and a half. And those things would be the who I am, the what I am. Then I want to give them some of my key qualifications, some of my core competencies, and then quickly demonstrate one of value by using a bit of a value proposition. I also want to add in there one of my soft skills. Why are you going to like me? Why are you going to want to work with me? Why am I going to play well with others, in other words? And then I always encourage people to wind that up then by saying, so when I saw this particular posting, I was so excited because it's such a great match for my skill set. So I'm really anxious to chat with you further today, because that sort of brings that 1 minute to a closure. Otherwise, sometimes we have a tendency to keep rambling and tacking and adding and pinning the tail on the donkey, when really 1 minute, minute and a half should cover it.
Thank you, Joanne. Bill?
I come at this not too dissimilarly from Joanne. A couple things that I think people forget is most of the occasions when you would use a 1 minute commercial is in an employment environment. Somebody says, so tell me about yourself. What I find fascinating is in the first usually 2 minutes of most conversations, whatever you say, you could test them 5 minutes later and the person you're talking to wouldn't remember what you said. And why? Because in the first 2 minutes, they're trying to remember what the heck they did with their resume because they haven't looked at it yet. So it's really not about how brilliant is the content. To me, I call it the picture frame theory. You go into someone's house and the picture frame is a little off and you don't pay attention to the content of the picture. All you think about is, dang, I really want to straighten that frame up. In interviewing, so there's a propensity to want to over-communicate, thinking somehow more is better. And so what I tell clients is really nobody cares. The key is, are you saying what they expect to hear anyway so that they don't really have to listen? So the one-minute commercial, and I usually shoot for about 45 seconds, is built around this idea of this is what I am. And I try to get clients to build a model around this, and I'll talk in a second about what I do with it and to tell them to throw it out. But initially, it's this is what I am. This is what I do. And what I do, of course, should be directly aligned with what you know they want, because that's what the job description asks for. Why talk about 15 things that have no bearing on the job? By doing these things, I've been able to create value. You know, these are some of the results that I've been able to generate, not more than three results. And then finally, you know, this is what makes me successful, the behavioral traits that make me successful. I call it a 3x3 model only because in learning theory, we tend to remember things in groups of threes in ways we don't anything else. We had three little pigs, three bears, three billy goats when we were kids, and there's a reason for that. It's because three tends to resonate. So this is three parts. This is what I am. This is why I can say it, my results. These is how I am, the behaviors that make me successful. And then I tell them, throw it out, because now that you got that, now start with what you love. Nothing gets people's attention more than someone who's passionate and enthusiastic about what they do. You know, I got to tell you, what I really love doing is building processes that drive value. I can get all these people put together. Suddenly, the entire conversation changes. The content may still be the same. But when you talk about what you love, it imbues everything that comes after with a sense of ownership and a sense of enthusiasm. And that's what people will remember. Not that you have these key words, but that you seem to love what you do. And people like to be, you know, ride with people who really love what they do. So find the passion in it, as well as the specific details of what might be necessary for the audience.
Thank you, Bill Temple. Valerie L. Jamil, I have a question for you. I know you believe that these days, with the social media making an attention span that of a gnat, I think you feel that the one-minute commercial may be considered old-fashioned and out of date now. Can you talk a little about that and how that would impact a value statement, as Bill has described?
Certainly, Fred. When I've worked with a lot of executives who come to me with their one-minute commercial, and I get bored listening to it, and I do think that social media has become one of those creatures that has changed how we communicate overall, and people expect things in shorter, more concise bites. So what I do when I'm working with someone is I will help them create a statement that brings in, as Bill said, things they love, because people want to know what you're passionate about. And I'm just going to throw a quick example out of how I would build one based on a client's resume that I just randomly brought up this morning. So it would be, I'm a strategic sales and business growth leader who loves developing top performers and leveraging strategic relationships both inside the organization and outside so that I can drive revenue. And I do this by fusing my background in growing organizations, business development and account management with my business operations experience. So, Fred, I would be happy to answer any questions you have about my background and my resume. But maybe a great place for us to start today is, what was it in my resume that caught your attention, and how does that relate to what you want to accomplish with the person who will fill this role?
Very good, Valerie, because the end closing calls for another probe by the hiring authority. And that is an engaging technique for conversation, as opposed to sitting there like a knot on a log and expecting them to ask you all the questions. As I say, communication's a two-way street, so you got to, as a give and a take, as an ask and a tell.
And to your point, the feedback that I've had with the candidates who have used this technique is that how different these interviews or these networking conversations, if this can be adapted for a networking conversation, but how different they become, because the potential employer, the interviewer, just all of a sudden is talking about their company and what they're really looking for. And so they can make, you know, the candidate can sit there and make off their checkoff list that they know all the key points they need to hit when they're talking.
Right, because they've already defined their competencies and they have value propositions that attach to those that are quantifiable and measurable. One of the things that I say to clients is, think about this. if they pay you X dollars and you have a 25% benefit package, you multiply that times the X dollars, you got a cost basis. That's not the true cost basis. True cost basis is all costs of the company applied to that particular job, as a cost accountant would do. So the question then becomes, what is your multiple of that cost? Because they're not going to hire you just to pay you cost. They want to get something for their money more than they're investing. Like a stock on Wall Street, isn't it? It's a price earnings ratio. The higher the PE, the greater the risk, but also the greater potential return. So it's the same thing. The job seeker must communicate with the hiring authority that value proposition that says, if you hire me, I will deliver multiples, either top or bottom line, to this company. Bill Temple, what do you think about that?
There's no question about the fact that this is an economic world we live in, and part of the differentiation is a price-benefit ratio. There's also another element to this, though. I mean, there's the IQ versus EQ. The IQ are the numbers, the metrics, the performance things that usually will get you in the door. Those are the things that attract somebody's attention, as we talked about, putting numbers up front and emphasizing the economic value, what I call the so what answer in an achievement. It's not just I did it, it's so what? Why did I do it? Because of the value that I created. When you get into the interview, however, those are not unimportant, but the numbers take secondary position to the EQ. So how did you do that? How well did you relate to other people? How did you solve these kinds of problems? How did you negotiate the availability of resources with your organization? How did you handle that difficult problem with an employee? Did you hire from within or promote from within or hire from without? I mean, it's more about how do I feel about you being part of my team, because I wouldn't even be interviewing you presumably if I didn't think you were a decent fit. Why would I waste my time and money? It's more about how do I feel about you doing it? Are we going to be able to produce together? Are we going to be able to create value together over time? And so I think it's important to recognize that while numbers are not unimportant, by the time you get into a conversation, a lot of it is about how are we going to make this happen? You, Mr. Jones, and your organization. I tell clients when you go into an interview, you're not going into the interview to get the job. And so much as you're there, they must assume you can do it. So treat the interview as though you've already got the job. And therefore, I don't have to sell anything. I'm here to figure out how are we going to do this together? How are we going to work together? How are we going to get to that point in the future where my background and my experience, my stories of my capabilities align with what you have told me you find important, which may only cover 12 to 13, 14% of my background and my experience, but it's close to 100% of what you need to know, Mr. Jones, at this point in time in order to achieve an objective.
Thanks, Bill. Joanne, how do you approach your clients on this, the integrating the EQ as well as the IQ and probably the AQ, the adaptability quotient?
Well, I think I have to concur completely with Bill that it is you are selling, but you are selling the total package. You are selling yourself as a person, because we've all known people that we had no doubt that they were brilliant, but we knew that we couldn't work with them or for them. So as Bill said, you should already assume I got this nailed, but now let's get on with how we're going to go about making it work. So I think I would have to agree pretty wholeheartedly with Bill on that.
One of the things that we all experienced, everybody that I have ever met in my life who attended the first grade, avoided the bullies, and they gravitated toward people that treated them nicely and that they got along with. How does that differ when you're 50 years old or 40 years old or a millennial in the workplace? You gravitate toward those people that you are comfortable with, and you avoid those that you're not. So an employer who's bringing someone in to fill a position, they're not saying, I'm hiring 160 IQ and I don't care how he treats people or she treats people. It's a balance, isn't it, everybody?
No question. It has a lot to do with the culture of the organization. And certain organizations really are hard driving. The Amazons of the world really don't care about how warm and fuzzy it is. They want to know how fast can you do it and how quickly can you do it and how profitable can we be doing it. And those are environments for certain types of personalities. But I've had people who have come into those spaces and just couldn't stand it because there was no sense of camaraderie because we're too busy focusing on getting something done. Other environments are much more about we as a culture, the brand of the organization is very much who we are as people and how we treat one another. And that message goes out to the community because it reinforces our services and our products. And that makes a big difference. So I think the point I guess I'm trying to drive at here is there's no cut and dried answer to that so much as the person going into an environment, one of the responsibilities that an individual has as a candidate for him or herself is to say, how do I feel about this group? Is this an environment in which I'm going to feel successful because it aligns with kind of who I am? If I'm a hard-driving personality and this is a very laid-back nonprofit organization who's going to get to it sooner or later, probably not a good fit. And it's as important for the employee to think about that as it is for the employer to consider it. Because I've had clients, unfortunately, take positions thinking it was going to be terrific and not very disappointed because it just didn't gel. And I think part of my job as a coach, frankly, is to understand or listen for those kinds of characteristics and the feedback during the process of interviewing and debriefing.
Well, I'd like to thank all of you today, Bill Temple, Valerie L. Jamil, Joanne Mosier, three of the best coaches in the United States on job and career transition, for joining us today on Workplace Strategies. Thank you, everyone.
You're welcome, Fred.
You're welcome.